The history of Chianti is closely related to the wealthy merchant and bankers Florentine families. Chianti, over the centuries, has become synonymous of Italian red wine, but it has been deeply flawed due to poor regulation and quality controls. For that, it was argued that Chianti, it was a style of wine and it doesn't represent the region. With my returning guests, Francis Savino and Bill Nesto, Master of Wine, authors of Chianti Classico, The Search for Tuscany's Noblest Wine, we discussed what has led to this point, and most importantly, how Chianti is finally changing to focus on quality and selections after a long history of sharecropping, governo and fiascos, all those discussed in the episode. If you enjoyed this podcast, remember to hit the follow button to know when the next podcasts are coming up.
Hi, I'm Mattia Scarpazza, and this is the Looking Into Wine podcast. Wine and winemaking can be complex, but this podcast has a simple mission. We want to give you the skills and tools to harness your passion about wine. Through this series, we will shine a spotlight on some of the different regions, process, and concepts that shape the fascinating world of wine. I hope you enjoy the show and your own journey, Looking Into Wine.
Welcome to the Looking Into Wine podcast. I'm Mattia Scarpazza, your host, and today with me are the authors of Chianti Classico, The Search for Tuscany Noblest Wine, a very layered book that traces the history of Chianti Classico. I welcome back to the show Bill Nesto, Master of Wine, and Francis Savino, who were previously guests on the Evolution of Sicilian Wine episode. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mattia. An honor to be here with you and your listeners.
Thank you. It's been fantastic last time in the interview, and has been a great success, and I'm very happy to have you on the show. And you have your first book was on Sicily, and your second book now is on Chianti Classico. What was the inspiration, and why did you choose to write about Chianti Classico?
Well, Fran had been living in Greve in the 1980s, and she was actually right in the heart of Chianti Classico. But she was really working on her law degree and improving her Italian, living with a family who was really had land since the 15th century in Greve, farmed land. So she was there really early, but I came to probably Chianti Classico, Florence and Chianti Classico was the first zone that I visited in Italy in 1994, probably. The origin, I think Fran and I are both very much attracted to culture, and there's no place in Italy, or really Florence and Siena are very high on the list as sort of cultural high points. Fran, what do you think?
I think as well, Mattia, in telling the story of Sicily, we came to understand more profoundly that Sicily shared something with Chianti. In addition to Marsala, Chianti was one of Italy's most famous and esteemed wines in the 19th and perhaps even earlier. But in addition, as a name, by the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, it was widely known. Both had become, in a sense, essentially highly branded. But as places, both Sicily and Chianti were largely unknown and misunderstood. And they both have majestic landscapes and fascinating histories, but those histories are laced with complexity and conflict. So after we finished The World of Sicilian Wine, Chianti and the story of the true Chianti, Chianti Classico, seemed like a worthy challenge for our focus.
I mean, I read most of the book, and as I think is the layers of complexity in the history of Chianti is incredible. I mean, it's very entwined with the history of Florence, which is close by. And I think my first question: why did Chianti was so important for Florence, and why Chianti? Why planting in Chianti?
Well, Chianti was always known as an area where excellent wines were made. And just like any important area where wine is made, it was sort of trafficked in Florence and Siena in the fairs. And basically, the people who were selling Chianti, a lot of times were there was a lot of sort of phony Chianti, in other words, wine which didn't come from Chianti there. And over time, what Chianti was became sort of mysterious, in part because Chianti was always associated with the Chianti Mountains and an area really roughly defined by Castellina, Rada, and parts of Gaiole. And because it didn't have a distinct border, it caused confusion, and then, of course, the mercantile sort of misuse of the word Chianti also made it confusing.
But I would say for the Florentines, the landscape of Chianti has really almost mythic or epic significance for it, since Chianti's history is tied up with the history of Florence, and it was essentially a battlefield between the Florentines and the Sienese from the 12th century till Florence conquered it in 1555. And so when the Florentines did finally assume control of Chianti at the beginning of the 13th century, they formed a military league. And I think this was hard won. And through the centuries, whether it was the Sienese or the Aragonese or the various imperial powers who were in fact waging a proxy war on Chianti's vineyards and in Chianti's hills, Chianti was hard-won territory. But as we point out, for those people who go to the Palazzo Vecchio, the town hall, city hall in Florence, they can see an image personified by a mature Bacchus of Chianti, which signified its reputation in the mid-1500s as being a region known for its excellent wine that had the capacity to age. And I think the reason for that is there was a fundamental appreciation going back to probably the early 1400s or even 1300s, that the natural characteristics of Chianti, which were, you know, the high hills and valleys and rocky, lean soil, were well suited to dedicated vineyards that produced wines with higher acidity because of the cooler climate.
I mean, I was standing out on many of these like historic Chianti family that have been around for the last 800 years. They were there, but mostly not to produce wine. I know that like they were doing like also other and waging the war, as you were saying. And it's so fascinating to know that this family, they've been around for so long and producing Chianti. And so, well, how did Chianti evolved during the early centuries? What was in the export market, you were saying like the fraud, how did that came about and why did the tarnish almost a bit of the name of Chianti?
Well, Chianti is important in part because, of course, it's in more or less the center of Italy. Its evolution sort of represents the evolution of the Italian wine culture and how it looks on the whole issue of terroir. If one reads our book closely, one realizes that really the issue of terroir was fought over in Tuscany, and the battle was between wines of place, which was really something that really was evolved to be quite strong culturally in France and southern Germany, wines which really were sort of created in particular wine styles and branded enological wines, one might say, which was something that seemed to have more validity in Italy, particularly central Italy. Piemonte has always had a closer relationship with France. And there, actually, in our book, you can see how it was really the Piedmontese who took a step forward in identifying place, whereas the Tuscans hopped onto the bandwagon of vini tipici, which became a legal name during the fascist period in the 1920s and 30s for wines which really represented wine styles connected to place, but they were primarily wine styles.
And I think the larger landscape for the understanding of Chianti is really an understanding of the evolution and really devolution of agriculture in greater Tuscany and ultimately Chianti. So when we approached this story, Mattia, we asked ourselves, why in a culture like Florence and Siena which had elevated art and architecture and the study of the humanities and the revival of classical learning, including the great agricultural treatises of Pliny and Varro and Columella, why was not wine put on an equal pedestal with those other aspects of culture in the same way that happened in France? And so we focused our research in answering that question on agriculture and the system of land tenure that developed in Tuscany generally, and ultimately in Chianti, but to a lesser extent. And that was the classic Tuscan mezzadria system, which was a form of land tenure that essentially the Florentines in particular perfected for almost seven centuries. So in its initial incarnation in the 1200s, Florentine landholders leased out their land, and initially they actually invested in dedicated vineyards and often reserved the planting intending of those vineyards for their own or for salaried workers' efforts. And then they left for their tenant farmers the cultivation of grain and fruit trees and other crops. But with time, it became much more profitable, since this system of sharecropping essentially involved the advancement by the landowner of capital to plant land, and then a sharing. Mezzadria comes from mezzo, half, a sharing of the resulting crop. So it ultimately resulted in a system of mixed planting, which involved principally in lower-lying areas in Chianti and throughout most of Tuscany, tree-trained vines, as opposed to vines in specialized vineyards that were trained on stakes and given the kind of careful cultivation that's necessary for quality wine. And this became a highly profitable way for managing the land. And the Florentines, as you know, perfected contracts, perfected double entry bookkeeping, and they brought that know-how of commerce to their countryside, but ultimately became a system that stifled agricultural innovation and led to poor quality grapes and poor quality wine. And the exception really through the mid-16th century were the high elevation areas in Chianti. And those high elevation areas were still making wines from high sites involving dedicated vineyards and producing higher quality wine.
Those were in the Chianti Classico area, I believe.
Correct.
Yeah. But, you know, even today, working, you find very little Florentines and Sienese working in vineyards. Agricultural work is looked on as sort of the lowest form of work. And basically, family members who go in are starting to go into work in wineries, but it's usually at the high managerial level or, you know, in marketing. But Tuscans are not connected to agriculture. They were, you know, they made their money in banking and things like silks. And when finally those sources of revenue dried up and they realized they had to make their money from agriculture, agriculture was looked on as something that only the lowest echelons of society did. Whereas if you go up to Piemonte, the story is completely different. You have family members working in the fields, coming up, taking an active role. So it's really eviscerated. The Tuscan culture has sort of disassociated itself from agriculture in a way which is very harmful to the development of a society where agricultural expressions are expressions of terroir.
I mean, when the mezzadria sort of finished, and when there's been the shift towards making single crop vineyards, when did this happen? What sort of period are we talking about?
Well, the devolution of the mezzadria system began in the 1950s. It really was accelerated dramatically in the 1960s and early 70s, and by the mid 80s, there were virtually no mezzadria left. It was a kind of population which really was looked down on by Florentines. There were like two classes of people. There were the mezzadri, and then there was the typical people of the area. They dressed differently, and they looked. You see pictures. There's a great picture in our book, and which has a mezzadri family pictured next to landowners, and you can see how different it is.
Oh, from the Pomona.
The Villa Pomona. And it's
So I saw it in the book actually today. I was having a read through again, and I saw actually the book. And I mean, for me, it's just, I don't even know how to describe it, but it's so interesting to understand it, and Chianti in Tuscany, how like recent actually the shift has been. It's right. Only been around for like 70 years, and the history goes back from hundreds of years, and been making Chianti wine for centuries. And how did the also like other decision that led to the sort of demise of Chianti that ultimately changing now, it was like the fiasco. How did that not help, basically, the flask?
Well, the fiasco was an evolution of a misunderstanding, really, of what Baron Ercastoli did in the 1840s to 1870s. It was his version, the kind of wine that was in the fiasco was his version of common wine from the area. The wine he made for his clients from his own estate grapes was basically at least 80% Sangiovese, with the balance being Canaiolo, was not made in with a Governo, which is an addition of sweet must, which gave it a slight fizz. And the shape of the fiasco, which really was a beautiful shape, I actually love the fiasco and with the straw bottle, that came from the late Middle Ages. And, you know, there are frescoes you can see in Florence from the 15th century where, you know, they're carrying around fiascos. But so the fiasco wasn't the problem in one sense, but it was the problem in another sense. It was so identifiable for branding purposes that you could see it immediately and say, that's Chianti. And so however beautiful and historic the fiasco was, as a container, it became the downfall of Chianti the wine, because it became the container for just wine, which really was the creation of disenfranchised of really owners who didn't play any role in the making of the wine, and Mazzadri, who really didn't care, and it created a style of wine which was very cheap. And became was very easy to drink, and had limitations as far as true quality and longevity were concerned. And longevity is a key factor in the quality of wine, whether wine can persevere in it.
I
was just going to say, much like the name Chianti, the flask, I mean, it used to represent an iconic place and an iconic wine. But the adoption of the name, the adulteration of the wine by merchants, both within and outside Chianti, beginning in probably the first decade of the 1600s, led to essentially a dilution and tarnishment of the name Chianti, of the reputation of Chianti wine, and the flask is a part of that story. So unlike, for example, the form of the Coca-Cola bottle, which is unique to the product Coca-Cola and is protected by trademark law, the flask had no such protection. And as Bill said, it increasingly was filled with cheap red wine from all over Italy, and therefore effectively damaged the reputation of Chianti. And Chianti went from being an iconic wine to a generic wine.
I mean, in the book, there was it transpired this the difference between the Chianti Classico and the Chianti, the fight they had over the centuries to sort of Chianti Classico, they wanted to separate themselves, and Chianti, they want to be part of them. And there was a quote which was basically saying that Chianti is a style of wine and is not a wine of a specific zone. And that sort of really, I think it was the key point of like what made me think about the whole this fight they had, and how did this solve? Like, when did Chianti finally separate from Chianti Classico? When this separation happened, and what the resulted?
Well, the interesting thing is that there was always confusion, and you know, we went back and did some research in the early 18th century in Siena da Balia. There was a council of of the Sienese politicians and landowners. And this was at the time when it was about to be announced of the 1716 Bando, which would basically put a lot of Sienese production outside Chianti. And the same issues were brought up then, is that, hey, look, we've been making Chianti too. Our wine is Chianti. This is not fair. So the, you know, this problem of what is Chianti and what isn't is ancient. And it comes partly from the fact that Chianti is a frontier. And even when you go to Chianti, it's sort of circled by highways. There are no major railroads that go through it. And historically, it was always a no man's land, a rocky place where it was hard to even grow things. And so it sort of, you know, really was unable to identify itself. In fact, there was a railroad that tried to be a sort of a channel for Chianti, what I call the Tranvia, and that never took root. It was basically phased out in the 1930s. But Ricasoli had to send his wine, initially by horse and carriage, and then by lorry. And so Chianti didn't have a means to identify itself. It was really defined by the perimeter. And on the perimeter, there were merchants who basically did make Chianti as they pleased.
So what Bill's alluding to, Mattia, with respect to the 1716 Bando, is the fact that the Grand Dukes of Florence from the 1600s and early 1700s understood that Florence was no longer the epicenter of commerce and finance, and that ultimately its wealth needed to increasingly come from agriculture and the fruits of the land, specifically wine. And because Chianti, again, beginning in the early 1600s, was often emulated and adulterated and was compromising the ability of the Florentine state and the Grand Duchy of Tuscany to export Florence wine, which Chianti was often called on the English market, there was this law, this executive decree passed in 1716. And I'll fast forward, but I'll just say that law both created a regulatory system and delimited four principal prestigious wine regions within the Florentine state, Chianti being first among them. And the promulgation of that law and the context for it is the subject of a historical mystery, a detective story, which ends our book called The Medici Code. When we were outlining our research for Piero Antonori, he said, "This is fascinating. It could be a thriller." And we said, "Yes, like the Da Vinci Code." And, you know, we had that in mind as we did it, our research. But fast forwarding to the end of the 19th century, when much of this history dating from the early 1700s was apparently long forgotten, the production of Chianti by growers and the sale of it by merchants with the arrival of railroads was becoming industrialized. As Bill said, particularly on the periphery, in Pontefiseve to the northeast of Florence and Poggibonsi to the southwest of Florence, where there was easy access for merchants of wine to ship Chianti both internally to Italy and ultimately for export. And it's in that context that there were the kind of the seeds of this discord were planted probably most firmly, because this conflict between the true Chiantigiani, the growers within historic and geographic Chianti, and these merchants from outside Chianti began to take root. And the larger landscape for it in the late 1880s and 1890s was that this was a time when the European powers were beginning to memorialize the concept of designations of origin and geographical indications on agricultural products like wine. And so the issue of what is Chianti by the first decade, really the last decade of the 1800s and first decade of the 1900s, became a subject of intense commercial, political, and legal debate. And that debate, we would submit that one cannot understand the evolution of either Italian wine law, or more importantly, Italian wine, for your listeners and all lovers of wine, without understanding this fight. Because as Bill pointed out, this fight pitted the merchants who wanted the law, Italian wine law, to embrace marketplace typicity, or vino tipico, as Bill described earlier, as opposed to the French concept and the concept that the Chiantigiani wine growers were putting forth, which was a true typicity of place. And again, which was already conceptualized and which was the first appellation of origin wine law in the world in that 1716 decree, which was a typicity that looked at the place of origin, the quality of the wine, and the reputation. Ultimately, the merchants won that fight, and that was memorialized in the 1932 fascist decree, which defined Chianti as a grand area that encompassed most of Tuscany, with Chianti Classico only representing one of seven subzones.
I mean, it's fascinating, this story. How, like, this historic area is so battled between the commerce and the money side and the historical side and the value. That there's this fight and the is still there, and I believe. But also in the last 100 years, so much have changed it, as you said, there's a 1930 the decree, and but also, like, Del, I wanted to ask how this the thrive of like big IGT wines, like the most famous wines from the Chianti area, have not been branded as Chianti. Well, how this came about?
The problem was that the image of Chianti had descended so much in the 1960s and 70s that Tuscany at this time was getting a much better image. I mean, fashion, Gucci, all these, you know, Tuscany was becoming, particularly Florence, was becoming a high fashion, very luxury oriented place. But they needed a wine to fit that whole sort of standard, and a wine where profit could be made. And so basically that's where the Super Tuscan category, which initially was a category without a place in the appellation system, it was a Vino di Tavola. Later in 1992, Law 164 created the EGT category. Some of those Super Tuscans became EGT, some of them became DOC, some of them became DOCGs, whatever, wherever they went. But the problem was that Chianti didn't become wasn't a profitable vehicle, and wasn't a vehicle that suited the status of really the resurgence of Florence as a very important center of culture.
Yeah, it didn't fall. And also with this IGT came through some of the most infamous winemakers of the last centuries in Italy, Tacchis, Giacomo Tacchis doing the Sassicaia and Tignanello. How him and also another winemaker that you mentioned in the book, Giulio Gambelli, how did they shape the modern Chianti, and what was their influence?
One of the themes of our book is that Italy has always looked to France. There's been waves of French enological influence in Italy, because the Italians have always looked up to France, with good reason, for their enological and viticultural prowess. And so at this time, again, Tuscany looked to France. And they looked to France, particularly through the channel of the Antinori family, Giacomo Tacchis, who brought in Emile Peynot, and in came French Barriques, in came Merlot, Cabernet, different ways of doing viticulture. And so this was another time when French technology came in like a wave. And sort of rejuvenated for a time the wines of Tuscany. I don't know. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It makes sense. And I think it's such a complex topic, the recent history of Tuscany, and I'm trying to untangle it and make it understandable how there was this bad position of Chianti, and that allowed to create, and I think paraphrasing, that created the opportunity to create this Tignanello and the Sassicaia and the Super Tuscans coming through. But also, when you're mentioning about the grape varieties, I was reading on your book, I love the story of Sangiovese, how at some point it wasn't even the main grape variety of Tuscany. Well, how did that change?
Well, I think We mention a manuscript and an author dating from the mid-16th century who's basically unknown and forgotten about. We can try and figure out why, but at any rate, it seems like he was just at a point where the Mesidria system became hardened. And the Mesidria system really depended on Mezzadri, who weren't interested in making great wine, and landowners who weren't interested in knowing how to make great wine. And the result was a move away. Our thesis is a move away from the great wines of Chianti, which were based on Sangiovese, or Sangiovetto, they called it. And this is a thesis which I think we're the only ones who's presented it. And it's interesting that it hasn't been challenged, because it's a revolutionary thesis that basically it wasn't Ricastoli who really discovered the primacy and promoted the primacy of Sangiovese. It was this other farmer in the mid-16th century. And even Ricastoli really depended on Giorgio Perrin, who was the former owner of Petrolo, what's now Petrolo, who had isolated Sangiovese as the best variety in his property. So we've basically rewritten the history of Chianti Classico. But as I underline again, it's sort of amazing that this revolutionary sort of contention has not been challenged. But we want to learn. You know, this book for us is not the end of our research. We're looking for more excitement and interest to be created from it.
So, Mattia, in our experience, and it's remarkable to this day, if you ask some of the most experienced people, be they producers or officials of the consortium, about the history of the appellation, they will put forth a narrative that describes the wine of Chianti being a vermiglio, a red wine principally made of Canaiolo. Maybe it was treated with a governo, and Bill can describe that a bit more. And as Bill indicated, that it was in the mid-19th century when Chianti and Tuscany's noble variety was first singled out. That is the narrative. And yet what that narrative masks, because so often history is written by its patrons in the same way that art is so largely religious in nature because its patrons were ecclesiastical institutions. But when you peel back the veils of history, what we discovered is that at the height of the Renaissance, in high elevation sites and liminal growing areas of Chianti, that indeed it was Sangiovese as the noble variety. And that Vermiglio was a wine, but it was made in areas outside of Chianti by Mezzadri, by these sharecroppers who planted Canaiolo up trees, because Canaiolo, I think, is early ripening, right? They probably got more volume. Their economic incentives, obviously, were prized quantity over quality. And so I think that is one of the biggest revelations in our book.
Canaiolo was easy to, also much easier to dry, to make dry grapes. And Canaiolo and Malvasia were really important constituents of Vinsanto, which was really the grape of the Mezzadro, primarily. It's what the Mezzadro harvested before the major crop, and so he didn't divide it with the with the owner. And this was, of course, always an issue of contention with the owner about the grapes that disappeared prior to the harvest, but they were dried, and they had two uses, these grapes. One was for Vinsanto, the other one was to use as a governo. So the Mezzadri were perfectly positioned to make vermigli, because they also had the governo, which was sort of like an additive, which could give more a second fermentation, which gave more alcoholic content, but also a little spritz, a little fermentation aroma. And so it was the Mezzadri system, which created Chianti, the Chianti, not the Chianti families in the end, or the Chianti that became worldwide. And the Mezzadri, the culture of the Mezzadri, evaporated in the 1960s. So something else had to take its place.
Okay, and so basically you were saying that then back in the days, so Canaiolo would be, wine based on Canaiolo would be still be called Chianti for hundreds of years, and the Sangiovese of Castellina, Radda, all these areas, they would be still Chianti. There was no diversification among them, and it's baffling almost. Yes, it's very interesting. On the last decades, on the last 20, and actually since this Chianti 2000, and there was this part of the book, and it was the last 20 years, there's been this strong revival of Chianti, and they're trying to make it the differentiation, and they created the pyramid system, they have the Gran Selezioni, and on the top, how this new wave, what do you think about this new classification, this new embracing of quality for Chianti Classico? What is it doing?
They followed, was basically occurred in the 1990s and early 2000s, most of the research, and also the last half of the 1980s. And that followed the Super Tuscan Revolution. It was the money that came in through into the wine industry through the Super Tuscan Revolution, which really helped give drive, maybe money directly, to these to this research, and the research was interested, really helped Tuscans really refocus on the raw materials, and this was a good thing. In the end, they refocused on Sangiovese and its supporting varieties and viticultural systems in a scientific way, and the studies were very well done. Unfortunately, climate change was also occurring very dramatically this time, and for instance, they were selecting early ripening clones of Sangiovese when they maybe should have been selecting late ripening clones, because the climate was changing dramatically. Well, dramatically from the perspective of a farmer, not from probably someone who lives in the city, but that really was a major force then. And so that, going into the 2000s, mid-2000s, there was a move away from the style of wine which characterized the 1990s, which was much influenced by the addition of Merlot, French varieties, Barriques. In other words, an overuse of French technology, mostly to please the American market, which was the most important market. And this sort of, again, much to the credit of Tuscany and Chianti, but they were really responding to the market too. There was a move away from this, and the Chianti 2000 project came just at the right time to help fuel the move back to a more traditional sort of style of Chianti, Chianti Classico, which today is in my view what reigns over the sort of the more international Super Tuscan style.
Perhaps you could actually even add about the evolution of the Super Chianti, the 100% Sangiovese wines that, you know, predated the advent of the Gran Selezione and now the Subzone.
Well, there was always a move to, you know, the crazy thing was that in the 1970s and 80s, you couldn't make Chianti Classico without having white grapes in it. In fact, until 2006, actually. In 2006 they were actually disallowed, but maybe it went back to 1996 or something when you couldn't make theoretically Chianti Classico with having white grapes in it, and so there were some basic problems with the laws, and these had to be corrected. Ironically, Bettina Ricastli and this sort of writer, this farmer that we discovered, who was writing in the mid-16th century, their recipe is the recipe of today's great Gran Selezione wine.
So Ricasoli not only created the original recipe, but he also re-updated and rewrite it. He updated himself, basically, with the new updated version of the Gran Selezione recipe.
Right, but also wines from estates like Montevertine in the late 70s and 80s that were technically not Chianti Classico, made of 100% Sangiovese from high elevation sites, became iconic.
Yeah.
And so I think the world began to take notice, and there were many estates, a handful that started making these 100% Sangiovese wines, which of course were a counterpart to Brunello di Montalcino that had staked its claim on 100% Sangiovese. And I think Chianti Classico was showing its potential, which is even probably greater now because of those climate changes Bill alluded to. For
and Giulio Gambelli was the champion of Sangiovese, yes. And he was the champion of these 100% wines when made in a more traditional Italian way. And that's where Tancredi Biondisanti comes in, who was the teacher of Giulio Gambelli. He wasn't a student of Giacomo Tacco, of
Emile Peynot.
He was a student of
Gambelli. He did do the Pergole Torte, Monte Vetrine, on the first super Tuscan 100% Sangiovese. I mean, I got the last question for you, which comes from one of my listeners, because this is after you've published your book, and the thing about Gran Selezione has always been, until recently, has always been about the state, not the place. But now finally only recently they're doing the parcel from a particular villages and the subzoning of the Chianti Classico. What do you think about that, if you can express your ideas about it?
Well, you know, the movement's in the right direction. I think there's always the movement's in the right direction. There's always a conflict between big merchants and small growers, and the movement of the Grand Selection was sort of a compromise between the needs and desires of big merchants and those of small growers. But the UGAs is another step in the direction of making place important. And so we're positive about it. And we're also positive in making the Grand Selection category and the UGAs, because now they're, for the moment, to have the UGA name on your label, you have to be Grand Selection for the moment. The idea is that it'll filter down to the Reserva and Annata categories. But in this category, the wines will also be at least 90% Sangiovese, and the balance will be native red grapes.
It will be the first time in history that Chianti becomes officially a wine of a terroir or a particular area. I mean, on the label as well, it's always been, but it would be the first time, and then the law upset it, and it's exciting to see, because as of now, with the last few years, the recognition of the quality of the Chianti Classico has been growing, especially among critics and these sort of things. So for me, is a good sign of this future. Then it's coming across, and I'm quite looking forward to see what will happen with Chianti. I mean, we spent 40 minutes now chatting about Chianti, and I know there is more stories to be told, but there is much more on your book, and I really enjoyed reading it. And I mean, there's so much story, and there is also the part of the grape varieties. I loved it when you were talking about the clones of Sangiovese in the book. Is such an interesting topic, and I think there's so much to learn for every sort of wine lovers, from someone is new to Chianti, or someone who's very an expert on Chianti can always find something interesting. So for me, it's a very good balance, and I want to thank you to coming on today and talk to me.
Mattia, we want to thank you for looking into Chianti Classico and looking more importantly into the true Chianti, because as you know, it is in a magnificent region that's long deserved to be known by its own name, Chianti.
In this episode, we spoke to Francis Di Savino and Bill Nesto, Master of Wine, authors of the book Chianti Classico, The Search for Tuscany's Noblest Wine. If you'd like to reach us, you can do so on Instagram on Looking Into Wine, and Mattia Scarpazza on all other social media. Music produced by Samuele Di Nardo, editing and mastering by Tommaso Ascoli.